What we just heard was a movement of a string quartet by David Temperley, my cousin, who's a professor at the University of Rochester of the Eastman School of Music. And there'll be a link on our webpage to that, the full four movements of that quartet, if you're interested in more. The next topic we have to talk about is, I think, what's the next one of the big things in Bush's agenda for the next 4 years is the revamping of the Social Security system.
Yeah, the privatization of Social Security. As you no doubt have heard over the years, one of the big agenda item for the Republicans, and particularly the Bush administration, has been, in my opinion, the destruction of the Social Security system. And this goes under the rubric of privatization, or words to that effect. And there, obviously, if you have paid any attention to the news recently, are aware that they're ramping up their efforts now to do this, to privatize Social Security. And the strategy is a familiar one. It's one we've seen before. Step one is to create a sense of hysteria. So we have to create a panic about Social Security. So the thing that is going around at the moment all the time is, well, the Social Security system is unsustainable, cannot possibly continue, cannot possibly go on, and we must do something about it. And the solution that the Bush administration is pushing is really to do away with it. And they're all but saying that outright, but as usual, there are usual levels of dishonesty going on about what is really going on. So I wanted to talk about this some with our listeners, which you're welcome to call us at 412-268-9728. I think it's a very important thing because, you know, the Social Security system is enormously successful by practically any measure. It was instituted as part of the New Deal of the Roosevelt administration in the wake of the stock market collapse in 1929 and subsequent economic depression in the country. It's something that most people have taken for granted. It's for generations, and it really has been hugely successful. I mean, the amount of money, of course, that one can get from Social Security is minimal. I mean, living on Social Security is practically a poverty sentence, but it's better than having nothing whatsoever.
Yeah.
And, you know, but there are many, many people who live on Social Security and depend on it. And we should start out by saying, you know, that the name is significant because the idea is to provide Social Security. It's not supposed to be an investment scheme. It's not supposed to be a means for doing a speculation on the stock market.
Right.
It's not supposed to be, some kind of program for investing, but it's rather supposed to be a form of Social Security. It's supposed to be the safety net,
right.
the system of last resort for people who are poor enough that they're unable to fend for themselves after, for example, a serious debilitating injury that prevents them from working or retirement or eventually in retirement, where the majority of people benefit from the system. So here what we have is the Bush administration is attacking the Social Security system. And the first thing, as I say, is to create an atmosphere of hysteria that the system is untenable. Something has to be done right now. And the only solution is to privatize it. So in today's New York Times, Paul Krugman, who is otherwise on leave and hasn't been writing his regular column for at least a few weeks now, jumped in and has an irregular column today about it. And it was also commented on by Joshua Mika Marshall on his Talking Points memo on the web. And I'd like to point out a couple of these things that are mentioned here. So let me read you some excerpts from Krugman's column. If you haven't had time to read it today, I think it summarizes rather well what is really going on here. So the Krugman writes today in New York Times as follows. Privatizing Social Security, replacing the current system in whole or in part with personal investment accounts, won't do anything to strengthen the system's finances. If anything, it will make things worse. Nonetheless, the politics of privatization depend crucially on convincing the public that the system is in imminent danger of collapse, that we must destroy Social Security in order to save it. There's nothing strange or mysterious about how Social Security works. It's just a government program supported by dedicated tax on payroll earnings, just as highway maintenance is supported by a dedicated tax on gasoline. Right now, the revenues from the payroll tax exceed the amount paid out in benefits, and I will add that's been true since its inception. This is deliberate, the result of a payroll tax increase recommended by none other than Alan Greenspan 2 decades ago. His justification at the time for raising a tax that falls mainly on the lower and middle-income families, even though Ronald Reagan had just cut the taxes that fall mainly on the very well-off, was that the extra revenue was needed to build up a trust fund. And you've all heard about the Social Security Trust Fund. This could be drawn on to pay benefits once the baby boomers began to retire. That would include Danny and I, amongst many, many others. The grain of truth in claims of a Social Security crisis is that this tax increase wasn't quite big enough. Projections in a recent report by the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, which are probably more realistic than the very cautious projections of the Social Security Administration, say that the trust fund will run out in 2052.
No, wait, that's not 20. That's 2006, right? what did you say what that number was?
2052. Which is a little bit off from 2006. The system won't be, quotes, bankrupt at that point, even after the trust fund is gone. Social Security revenues will cover 81% of the promised benefits. Still, there is a long-term financing problem. It is 81%. But it's a problem of modest size. The report finds that extending the life of the trust fund into the 22nd century with no change in benefits would require additional revenues equal to only 0.54% of GDP. That's less than 3% of federal spending, less than we're currently spending in Iraq. It's only about one quarter of the revenue lost each year because of the President Bush's tax cuts, roughly equal to the fraction of those cuts that goes to people with incomes over $500,000 a year. Given these numbers, it's not at all hard to come up with fiscal packages that would secure the retirement program with no major changes for generations to come. It's true that the federal government as a whole faces a very large financial shortfall. That shortfall, however, has much more to do with tax cuts, cuts that Mr. Bush nonetheless insists on making permanent, than it does with Social Security. But since the politics of privatization depends on convincing the public that there is a Social Security crisis, the privatizers have done their best to invent one. My favorite example of their three-card Monty logic goes like this. First, they insist that the Social Security system's current surplus and the trust fund it has been accumulating with that surplus are meaningless. Social Security, they say, isn't really an independent entity. It's just part of the federal government. If the trust fund is meaningless, by the way, that Greenspan-sponsored tax increase in the 1980s was nothing but an exercise in class warfare. Taxes on working-class Americans went up, taxes on the affluent went down, and the workers have nothing to show for their sacrifice. But never mind, the same people who claim the Social Security isn't an independent entity when it runs into surpluses also insist that that late next decade, when the benefit payments start to exceed the payroll tax receipts, this will represent a crisis. You see, Social Security has its own dedicated financing, and therefore it must stand on its own. There's no honest way that anyone can hold both these positions, but very little about the privatizers' positions is honest. They come to bury Social Security, not to save it. They aren't sincerely concerned about the possibility the system will someday fail. They're disturbed by the system's historic success. For Social Security is a government program that works, a demonstration that a modest amount of taxing and spending can make people's lives better and more secure. And that's why the right wants to destroy it. And that's Paul Krugman in today's New York Times. We have a caller on the line. Caller, please go ahead.
You know, maybe we should break it down in even more simple terms and talk about the types of people that receive Social Security. You know, because there are a lot of people that receive Social Security that really didn't work for any big corporations, don't have any big nest eggs saved up from financial investments or anything like that, or retirement funds, you know. You're looking at a lot of folks, poor whites, poor blacks, Native Americans, and other folks that had jobs where they worked at places that didn't pay into the Social Security system, where they're eligible for Social Security benefits. Hello?
Yes. So you're saying they didn't pay into the system? Their jobs, their
well, you know, a lot of people had jobs like as day workers. People worked as maids and butlers.
Oh, right. I see. Now, those people aren't part of the system.
Your point is those people aren't covered at all.
The people they worked for did not pay into the Social Security system.
That's right, yes.
You know, and you have an overwhelming majority of people that were like that. You know, everybody didn't work for U.S. Steel.
Right. I think
everybody didn't work in the steel mills.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
Everyone didn't work for Giant Eagle or what have you. You know, everybody wasn't in a union.
Right. So that's a very good point, and I would actually like to amplify your point a bit, because even the people who did work for U.S. Steel or mm-hmm. people who did work for large corporations like U.S. Airways, as we'll notice in the news, the trend that's going on these days is that the companies are shedding their pension obligations.
Right.
So
and
even
that's been going
even
on with the steelworkers for a long time.
So even if you did work for one of these big companies, you know, the Republicans are always very fond of chastising the morality or the immorality or the laziness or the ineptitude of people who are poor. But here's people, and there are many, many, many thousands of them, who were hardworking, dedicated people who got their life together, who were working and depending on a pension. And they were maybe a member of a union, had a union contract, worked for a large corporation, were promised pension benefits. Mm-hmm. The pension benefits were promised to them in exchange for their labor. That was part of their terms of working. And now what happens to them when they get into retirement?
Well, we have bankruptcy. We can't possibly afford those pensions
anymore.
Then
they vacate those obligations.
You know, the LTV workers here in Pittsburgh.
LTV is a good example.
From Jones and Lachlan. Look how long those guys fought for their
And they get a tiny fraction.
They
throw out there.
This goes back to the 80s.
And the same goes. So the Republicans try to have it both ways. So mm-hmm. the first story is, oh, we should do all this by private means. I mean, the magic of the market. The free market automatically solves all problems. Don't you understand that? How ignorant are you? The free market solves all problems. So we can have the free market handling, medical insurance for employees. We can have the free market handling pension systems and so on. Except when the free market chooses that it's not convenient any longer, then they just jettison these programs.
The obligations.
And on top of it, to make it even more repugnant, are now attacking the Social Security system, the system of last resort, which pays people a pittance mm-hmm. to keep them from starving. It's a minimum. They're going after that. And they're going after the minimum wage.
And to say nothing about what's going on with the Medicare stuff.
They're going after 40-hour work week, you know, the time and a half for overtime. Thank you very much for that call.
Kevin.
Thank you for calling in,
Kevin.
Kevin,
right?
Yes, and thank you for listening to Left Out.
Right.
If anyone else would like to call, please feel free to do so. That's 412-268-9728. Okay, we have our guest is on the line. So, Danny, would you please?
Yes.
We'll come back to this topic in a few
We have
minutes.
On the line Terry Taylor. Are you there, Terry?
Yeah. Hi, Danny. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for calling. Terry Taylor is a freelance journalist. She's been on our show before to talk about longwall mining. She's done a documentary about longwall mining and a lot of other things as well over the years. Lately, she's been working on the Ohio election and the aftermath of the election in Ohio. And I'm hoping that we can just discuss, you can just summarize what's been happening over there and what you've been doing and what you've been seeing.
Okay, well, it's a big story, and I think the most interesting thing about it is that it's a big story that nobody is learning about.
That's a very good point, yes. So if you would please amplify this.
Well, nobody's hearing it on television or the radio. The only place you're going to get news about what's happening in Ohio right now, with very rare exceptions, is online. And just, you know, talking about it from a independent journalist perspective, the bloggers in the blogosphere are just really going for this. And I think it's splendid to see how many people are becoming journalists, and pretty damn good ones, too, and how many alternative journalists are just doggedly following this story in all of its dimensions. And I guess from my perspective as a journalist, what I want to tell people is that from all my investigations, research, interviews, and so forth in Ohio and just about the presidential election of 2000 in general, this is a case of massive voter suppression, probably massive inside-the-box vote tampering and rigging. And then there's the third part, which I don't want to spend too much time on tonight, but, you know, that has to do with the manipulation using the media of the public's mind in how they vote and what messages come out and how iconographically a cowboy has been created by the Republican Party to win as our president when he's not even a cowboy. So, you know, just the manipulation of the media in the post 9/11 world to create fear.
So that's a great topic.
And all that. But I don't want to go there. I want to talk to you about the vote.
Yeah, let's talk about it. So tell us more about the nature, the exact nature.
Yeah, most of my work is around voter suppression.
Okay.
And I did make a little film about what that was like in Allegheny County, and I'll just spend a second on that. In Allegheny County, folks might not know that we had the largest number of voter complaints about difficulty or inability to vote of any county in the United States, bar none.
Wow.
Okay, that was over 981 solid complaints, several thousand to various hotlines that were, you know, taking calls from people and trying to help them on Election Day, and also hundreds of signed and sworn affidavits. We are seconded only by Broward County, Florida, which had the second number.
Hmm.
And Pennsylvania as a state had ranks number two in voter complaints. And that's very serious because even though this state went for John Kerry, it was not nearly by the margin that was predicted and that was foreseen by the usually very accurate exit polls.
Yeah.
You know, so we have to even though we went for Kerry in this state, we have to look at what kind of voter suppression, what kind of vote tampering took place in Pennsylvania. And to that end, I just want to let people know that there will be a hearing before the county council. There will be public hearings, and they will be the 15th of December at 7 p.m., and they're going to take place in the city council chambers in the city county building downtown on Grant Street. So,
well, I can certainly affirm I worked as a poll watcher on Election Day, and I was busy from 11 hours straight working, putting out fires and dealing with plenty of problems with voter registration. People who, you know, I could tell tale after tale of many complications, people who were not registered, people whose registration had been changed, a whole variety of problems.
For sure. And you've listed a goodly number of things, and I would say that I've made a list of maybe 15 or 20 key ways that people were kept from voting.
What were the biggest, the ones that you saw in Ohio and Allegheny County as well?
Yeah. Now, you have to throw in there that there is some measure of ineptitude, administrative incompetence, overwhelm of the system because of newly registered voters, and also just the way that poll watchers and judges are selected. Most of these folks are very well-meaning people who want democracy to be exercised to its fullest, but they may not know the latest rules about provisional ballots. They may be older people in many cases who have been doing this for many, many years, not able to move people quickly through a line when there's many more people than before. And so I want to say that it's a combination of system failure from the perspective of it being a lousy system, and then also, devious and planned manipulation. And in that regard, the main things that we saw in Ohio, one of the ones that I think has the hardest primary evidence provable in a court of law would be the deployment of the voting machines themselves.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at Columbus, for example, that would be Franklin County, the machines were moved from the inner city out to the predominantly white, predominantly more affluent, predominantly Republican suburbs. So, for example, if you look at these lists, and we do have a copy of the computer printout of the deployment of voting machines in the Columbus area, you'll see that, for example, in one inner-city neighborhood, there might have been seven machines, even at the primary, for this election.
Wow.
And in the election of 2000 as well.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, for the general election, there were three. Mm-hmm. One was broken, and another one was on the fritz most of the time. And so what happened was you had massive lines. This also happened at universities. For example, at Kenyon College out in the middle of the state, those lines were 10, 12 hours long.
Oh, my God.
And in the inner city, 3, 4 hours was not out of the ordinary. I mean, there was one just particularly tragic case in which an older couple wanted to go and vote. Now, it was a rainy, you remember, it became a more and more rotten day as it went on.
Yep, or around here.
In more ways than one.
In more ways than one, yeah. And so this couple wanted to go to the polls together, and in the morning the husband didn't feel well. And he told his wife, you have to go for the both of us. You know, she wanted to stay home and, you know, be with him because he didn't feel well, you know. He said, no, you have to go. We've got to at least get one vote out of this family. So she went. She waited 3.5 hours. When she came home, he was dead.
Yeah.
He'd had a heart attack.
Sad story.
No, but you see, he might not have been dead.
Mm-hmm.
She might have been able to call the paramedics.
If she weren't in line. Yeah, it was terrible. There were certainly extremely long lines in where I was working here in Squirrel Hill in Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder
yeah.
if you could
yeah.
tell us more about the challenges that are being posed in
yeah.
Ohio.
Yeah.
Specifically in Ohio, I know that I've been getting some email from the Democratic Party and from Move On about this. I wonder if you could explain to our listeners.
Mm-hmm. The Democratic Party is pretty much a slow at bat here, but they have finally joined in one of the lawsuits. Which has to do with Delaware County, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
I got to back up a second. I think there have been almost a dozen cases in Ohio
uh-huh.
that started, you know, before the election. But in any event, there's a couple principal ones, and the one involving the Democratic Party in Delaware County goes like this. As you may be aware, the Green and Libertarian Party candidates called for a recount in Ohio. Under Ohio election law, they were able to do that. Any losing candidate can do that, and if they have under a certain percentage of the vote, which they did, you know, they were very, very minority candidates, they have to pay something like $10 per precinct. So they had to come up with, I think it was $113,000. In order to do a recount.
Hmm.
And they raised that money in a couple of days. They did it on Air America. They did it online. I mean, the power of the Internet is amazing as an organizational tool is one of the points I'm making here. But also, they raised this money fast. People wanted this recount. And so the next problem was that, of course, the Ohio Board of Electors actually certified the Ohio count just yesterday. And it was the goal of the recount folks to get the recount going before then, before Ohio certified, so that Ohio's vote was correct if there was any problem with it. And this went back and forth through various courts and wound up in federal district court. And the judge allowed the recount to proceed but would not accelerate it. So it probably won't even be completed before, you know, next Monday the 13th when the main Electoral College votes. And from Ohio we've got... just FYI, 20 Electoral College votes.
Right.
So anyway, what Delaware County did was it said, we're not going to participate in a recount. We challenge it. And they went and got a temporary restraining order so that they didn't have to participate. And this would throw off the entire state's recount.
Okay.
And might be followed by many counties who just basically said, screw you, we don't want to do it. So this is one court case that is still ongoing. The federal court judge said the recount can go on, but it cannot be accelerated. So it was kind of 6 to 1 side, half a dozen to the other. The recount will proceed, but it'll be a little bit late in the game, but then there's always impeachment.
Hmm.
But I say that a little bit tongue-in-cheek,
yeah,
but
mm-hmm.
It could be that the results change dramatically in Ohio once the recount is undertaken. One of the problems is that nobody has really had... lockdown control of the loose ballots. There are absentee ballots. There are provisional ballots that haven't been counted. In Ohio, there are, I think, 90-some thousand what we call spoiled ballots. And these are another bone of contention for how you get rid of votes. Spoiled ballots mostly come from bad voting machines. And the bad voting machines are guess where?
Mm.
In the inner city.
Yeah. Well,
90% of spoiled ballots were cast by African-Americans.
I want to come back to something you mentioned, which just strikes me as being the most smoking gun of this whole thing, which is the fact that somebody made a decision to move those machines out of the inner city neighborhoods to the suburbs. No, and that decision was, you know, it was a bizarre. It wasn't consistent with what they'd been done before, and it was obvious, and the result was predictable.
namely that people couldn't vote because they had to wait too long.
Right, and when you figure
isn't that a crime? I mean, that's not just like stupidity. You should lock up people up for that. It's an outrageous disenfranchisement of people. It's not just I made a little mistake. It's deliberate, destruction of the whole system, isn't it? I mean, am I missing something here?
I don't think so, and that leads us to yet another court case. And before I get to that court case, I just want to point out that this happened in other states. This happened in other counties. This happened in New Mexico. This happened in Florida. This happened in Wisconsin. It just seemed to be that there was a smorgasbord of ways to suppress the vote, including this one, which were not applied uniformly so that it didn't look like it was comprehensive across the board. Another example of that is provisional ballots. We know about this in Pittsburgh as well. If you got there and your name wasn't on the rolls, 9 times out of 10, the judge of elections at the precinct would tell you that you could file a provisional ballot. But Allegheny County, the Board of Elections, only put 12 provisional ballots at each polling place. Now, if you're in the inner city and you've got massive new registrations and the county has not gotten the names onto the rolls, all these new people show up and they've got their voter card, they've got their picture ID, but they're not on the list. And so they have to get a provisional ballot. And if there aren't any, they can't vote.
Oh, I saw that numerous times during the day.
Mm-hmm.
Wait, you said 1,200 per polling place, right?
12.
12. 1-2.
Yeah, it looks quite amazing.
And if you were number 13, you were out of luck.
Yeah, so there's
unless you roamed around looking for another polling place that might have a spare provisional ballot.
What excuse can they give for that?
It's appalling. They knew how many people had registered, even if they weren't on the list. And in addition to that, by law, anyone with a voter registration card and a valid valid piece of picture ID can vote on the machine. And the machine votes, at least theoretically, get counted on the day of the election. We don't even know about that, but you got a better chance of getting your vote in if you vote on the machine. If you vote on a provisional ballot, we don't know what happens to them.
But the thing is, that's another example of just a decision that was made that just seems...
criminal.
Criminal, right. That's the right word.
Yeah, okay.
What I was looking for.
So up we go to the most exciting lawsuit. And I happen to know about this, and it hasn't been filed yet. So I don't really know how much I want to say about it. But there's been talk about it even in the local press in Columbus. So I think I can go into it. And a lot of the stuff is on the record. Several weeks ago, the community of inner city people and I guess liberal folks who went in to help the election protection move on, everybody who went in to help in these high-risk precincts on election day, these people got together and they held their own public hearings that were generated from the community.
Mm-hmm.
And they did it very professionally. I was blown away. I never saw anything like this. It was an African-American Baptist church in the inner city in Columbus. There were about 500 people in attendance. They were hanging off the rafters, and they'd all come to testify and swear under oath about what had happened to them on Election Day. They're from all walks of life, and they included both the volunteers and the voters. There was a court stenographer. The whole thing was videotaped. There was a panel of 8 experts in the front, voting rights attorneys, various election experts, school department representatives, you name it, and people turned in a written statement, which they, my cell phone just went off. They turned in a written statement, which they swore under oath,
mm-hmm.
And all of these affidavits make a stack about 3 feet deep. And this is part of a major lawsuit, which is going to be filed any day now, which is going to contest the election in Ohio in its entirety and call for an impoundment of all the ballots and, depositions of, all kinds of very high-ranking officials. And it's a major, major lawsuit contesting the election, and this will be filed any day now.
What organizations do you know?
It's a hybrid that came out of all of this work. The lead attorney is Cliff Arnebeck, and he is also the lead attorney for Common Cause in Ohio. But in this capacity, they formed an organization called the Alliance for Democracy. And if Bob Fitrakis calls in from the Free Press in Columbus, he is the second attorney on the case, activist, journalist, an attorney. The third attorney on the case is Susan Truitt. Susan is well, she's an expert on black box voting. And she has been working very hard for lobbying for changes to the way that we vote system for years, and especially since 2000. She's an expert on Diebold, ESNS, Sequoia, all the companies who make the touchscreen and tabulator systems. And Susan is also an attorney. Her group is the Citizens Alliance for Secure Elections. And all these folks are online. And
yeah, I've got a link to Bob's website.
Yeah, freepress.org is Bob Fitrakis's great reporting. And it also comes out in a timely fashion.
Okay.
So you actually get updated pretty quickly. The Citizens Alliance for Secure Elections is, I think it's www.caseoh.org.
But anyway, we'll complete all the links on our website.
So there you go. But anyway, so there are three key attorneys, and this is an amazing case. It's the kind of case that a Kunstler would file. It covers a lot of ground, big, broad-reaching principles about, you know, the right to vote.
So what is the legal situation, though? I mean, I think the election will be pretty well settled December 13th, isn't that right? So
well, that's when the Electoral College
Officially meets, right?
Meets, yeah, mm-hmm. And I guess we will, you know, proceed along to the inauguration. Now, yesterday there was some civil disobedience in Columbus. There was a picket outside the Secretary of State's office. The Secretary of State is J. Kenneth Blackwell. He's an African-American. And also the chair of the Bush-Cheney 2004 reelection campaign. So Mr. Blackwell has taken heaps of abuse on how he handled the election in the state of Ohio. He has been called to testify tomorrow before the Black Congressional Caucus on Capitol Hill. As you're probably aware, Congressman John Conyers of Michigan and a number of his colleagues have gone and asked both for a GAO, Government Accounting Office, investigation of American voting procedures, and also the Congressional Black Caucus, which he is a key member of, have called for hearings. And they take place tomorrow. And they are on the Ohio vote.
Okay.
And so, you know, some of these people that I've mentioned, plus many others, will be going to testify. And
are these congressional hearings in Washington?
Yeah.
Okay.
Not before
you're going
full
down.
Congress, before the Congressional Black Caucus.
Okay, so you're going down to Washington yourself to cover that.
Yeah, in a few hours.
And
yeah.
What should our listeners do about this? What do you recommend?
Well, let's go see. There was a call last night online that would be interesting. I would say a lot of good information can be gleaned from freepress.org.
Okay.
And also Citizens Alliance for Secure Elections.
Let me ask you something slightly different.
I'm going to dig around for a piece of paper because there was a call to action, which if I could find it, I could pass it along to you.
Okay.
But let's keep talking.
Yeah. So this isn't getting any coverage in the mainstream media as far as I know. I mean, I'm not seeing any articles in the Post Gazette or
no. Supposedly a Washington Post reporter was down last week, but you know nothing ever came of it.
I mean,
supposedly
NBC
had a crew. There was nothing there.
The shame of it is that I mean it's almost to the point where you mentioned civil disobedience, where you know you have to do something. Something like that has to happen. You know, people have to you know slash tires or throw bricks through windows or something that to get any coverage of these events. I mean.
But even if they do that, they're not getting covered. There was a very large rally, again, in Columbus on Saturday. Really an amazing and powerful rally. People came in by the busload from California, Oregon, New York State.
Hmm.
And where was it?
It was in Columbus, but it was no coverage.
Yeah, but, you know, it's like, what's the sound of one hand clapping?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, that seems to be the typical story, all too typical.
Yesterday, there was a sit-in at Blackwell's office.
Yeah.
There weren't arrests. I think they, but, you know, it nearly came to that. I think that the Secretary of State didn't want to arrest anybody, because if he had, he might have, you know, made the AP or something.
Yeah. We need to wind up the...
We're running a little short of time.
Yeah, running out of time
okay,
here.
Okay, so, well, nice talking to you.
So, yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Terry.
Sure.
That was Terry Taylor, independent journalist who's been on Left Out before, reporting to us about the voting, the challenge on the presidential election results in Ohio and problems that we experience here in Allegheny County. So we'll try to keep you posted.
Yeah. So one thing that occurred to me was that I mentioned civil disobedience or, you know, the throwing of rocks or other disturbances to get attention. But if you think about what happened, for example, in Seattle during the World Trade Organization protests that went on there, it got coverage. It wasn't the media. But the way it was portrayed was that these guys are just they're kooks.
A bunch of kooks.
They're a bunch of kooks. They don't go and ask people, like, why are you doing this?
Yeah, outsourcing.
Who are you? Oh, well, I'm a professor. Or I'm a PhD student. Mm-hmm. I'm not a kook.
Yeah.
But they don't ask them why they're doing it. They just say these are kooks. They don't interview them. They say, it's very strange that these people are doing this. They're against, you know, the future,
free
Luddites,
free
trade,
the free market.
Yeah. So in any event, so it's very hard to get to break through that barrier of the press.
All right. Well, that's it for Left Out for this week. I think for this year, you've been listening to Left Out on WRCT. Thanks to Andrew Whittison for producing, and we'll be back again in
2 weeks.
2 weeks.